Welcome to the Wednesday night Brain Pick a Pro teleconference live from Lake Wylie, South Carolina and Charlotte, North Carolina. Special guest tonight is a real estate professional, a 1031 expert with Real Estate Exchange. Special guest is Bill Choate. Welcome to the show, Bill. How are you?
I am very well, Larry. Thank you very much for having me tonight.
Oh, it's going to be a lot of fun. We're going to learn a lot, and we're going to walk away learning how to save a lot of money. You know, one of the, and this just came to mind, but, you know, what do they say? A penny saved is a penny earned?
Well, that sounds like the right approach.
Especially with 1031s, and we're not talking about pennies here, are we?
Well, Larry, we've got some federal and state tax that we can save, and I think we can learn a little bit about how to do that through Code Section 1031.
That is great. Why don't you start out and tell us a little bit about yourself and your background?
Well, Larry, I've been in this business now, I believe it's going to be 15 years coming on April 2005, and I have done numerous exchanges and helped numerous real estate professionals and i.e. taxpayers save taxes through 1031. And my company, as I said, has been here now coming, it's 14 years coming on 15.
Wow, that is awesome. 15 years in the business. So
that's
you've seen it. You've handled a lot of transactions, haven't you?
Well, the funny thing is, every time that I say that I'm not going to be stumped again, sure enough, the next week I'll be in the books figuring out something.
You know what's funny is a lot of people think, you know, if you've been in real estate this long, you don't have to continue to learn and to buy the books and tapes and go to the seminars. But, you know, I've been doing this for 19 years, and I see new things all the time. When I first started out, everybody was looking for non-qualifying FHA assumable loans. Well, those have been gone for years and years. And even now with the new financing programs, the different, you know, the interest-only programs, option arms, all that stuff, you know, you have to continually look for new programs and new trends and ways to make transactions creative and stay within the guidelines and do good, clean business. So everything changes. So you have to keep learning, don't you? It's a learning experience.
There are new private letter rulings and court cases and things that come up in this industry pretty much on a weekly to a monthly basis. And it's we try to stay abreast of all the new changes and the twists as qualified intermediaries to help these taxpayers accomplishing a deferred exchange.
That is great. Well, let's start with the basics. Tell us, what is a 1031 tax deferred exchange?
Simply, Larry, it allows a taxpayer to sell one or more relinquished properties and buy one or more replacement properties of like kind. And this transaction simply would be one where a property owner reinvests the sale proceeds into another property. The economic gain basically is deferred and not realized. So, therefore, it would be unfair, I guess, to force the taxpayer to pay taxes on a paper gain.
Right.
Does that make any sense?
Simply said, you can sell a property and make a profit on it, but as long as you roll that money into another property of equal to or greater value, is that correct?
That is correct.
Along with the debt as well, then you can defer paying those taxes until you ultimately sell the second property or properties.
That's right. If I guess you say what you said, tax deferred. It's not tax free.
Right.
In essence, if you were to do a tax deferred exchange, theoretically, you could hold that piece of property, that replacement property, for a year. Let's say a year would be a good qualified use period to have held the property.
Uh-huh.
Meaning dealer property. In other words, if you immediately buy a piece of property and you turn around and you sell it, it's not qualified for tax-deferred treatment. So we want you to hold the property for a year or so. But if you were to replace into a property, and let's say you were to sell it, you know, a year down the road or even 6 months down the road and realize the gain, you would have to pay gain on the original gain as well as any gain you realized on the replacement property which you exchanged into. Does
uh-huh.
that make any sense?
Break it down a little bit.
Okay. In essence, if I sold a relinquished property and I rolled the money into the qualified escrow account, and I went and I purchased a replacement property.
Right.
What I did is I deferred gain
right.
on that relinquished property I rolled.
Uh-huh. On the one you sold.
Let's say that I don't want to hold that property forever. You know, it's not indefinitely deferred. I want my cash back. Well, in the event that you sold that replacement property, it's simply you would have to pay the gain that you originally deferred, as well as any gain that you had on the sale of the property. Does that make any sense?
Right, on both of them, because you have to play catch up.
That's right. But if you waited a year or waited throughout a qualified use period,
mm-hmm.
which there is no bright line ruling in the regulations which would state how long a qualified use period is.
Right.
We more or less know what it takes to establish that you've held a property for investment.
Uh-huh.
You probably ought not to fool around with any ownership attributes, debt equity ratios, or for lack of a better term, I guess any physicality, meaning an improvement,
uh-huh.
if that's a word, to the property.
Right.
And so, obviously, I want to hold it for a period of time, and there's no bright line ruling. I want to make sure I don't fool around, like giving gifts to my kids and then immediately thereafter doing a tax-free exchange.
Sure.
I don't want to fool around with any ownership attributes. And I certainly don't want to refi the deal in anticipation of an exchange because that would change up the debt-equity ratio. And the IRS may say to the extent that you pulled any money out, you did it in anticipation of this exchange. And therefore, it was part of the sale, and therefore we're going to tax you on the money that you pulled out.
Right.
So we want to make sure in holding a property for investment, we don't fool around with any of those three things. And again, that's the ownership attributes, the debt equity ratios, or the physicality, meaning improvement to the property in anticipation of doing an exchange.
Uh-huh.
Therefore, we're pretty much able to receive tax-deferred treatment from that standpoint.
Uh-huh. Now, you say there's no bright-line ruling, meaning there's no specific ruling on the amount of length of ownership of a property. Is that correct?
There is no bright-line ruling in the regs which would say that you have to hold it for 12 months and one day to qualify for code section 1031 tax treatment.
Right.
In other words, you can see, again, I'm not a CPA nor an attorney, but you can see some in the case law and the private letter rulings where some people may hold the property for the eight months and they may try to do an exchange, and the Internal Revenue Service say, hey, you move too quick.
Right.
You really needed to wait out a year, and you don't really see any case law. Once the taxpayer has waited a year, the IRS basically considers that to have held the property for investment.
Uh-huh.
And that's the key, is you don't want to fool around with the ownership attributes, the debt equity ratios, or the physicality, meaning improvement to the building, in anticipation of an exchange. You want to hold it in primarily the same condition for about a year before you're eligible.
Or at least, I heard someone say this one time, even if it's not a year, at least one tax period where you filed a tax return and had it, a whole tax period or whatever. I guess that would be a year, right?
We would recommend 365 days with one tax filing.
And
there is no bright line ruling in the regs which would suggest that that's the magic number.
Uh-huh. Right. So it is possible to do one, say, 3 or 6 months as long as you don't mess with any of these three items, the ownership attributes.
I would really consider 3 to 6 months to be too short.
Really?
In essence, you would need to hold the property for a longer period,
uh-huh.
straddling a tax year,
uh-huh.
than 3 to 6 months.
Right, okay. I'm with you.
Yes, sir.
That makes sense.
And we would ask the taxpayer CPA at that juncture to get involved and, to provide us with some case law or something that would suggest that we would even be the qualified intermediary at that juncture.
Right. So you can move forward.
That's right. I'm real I'm more on the conservative side because, obviously, as a qualified intermediary that's not an attorney nor a CPA, we certainly don't want to invite the IRS to come in and open up, you know, our 1031 books and say, all right, you boys, what are you up to here?
Absolutely. You know, yeah, especially since you're in the business. But also, you know, you don't want them to come and make a ruling that this is not a tax-deferred exchange, and then you've got the double whammy there of the one that you sold and the one that you bought and you know, moved on with it, too.
It's not. It would not be a pretty sight.
No.
That's for sure.
It would
tax not. Tax-deferred, not tax-free. The idea that I am under the understanding that if, for instance, you did do a tax-deferred exchange where you sold a relinquished property and you bought a replacement property through the avenue of 1031, and let's say that taxpayer were to die sometime later on down the road, the heirs get a step-up in basis, and therefore the heirs, theoretically, it would be not tax-deferred but tax-free.
Mm-hmm. Explain the step-up in basis for a lot of people that may not understand that.
Okay. In essence, the taxpayer, the original taxpayer that is now deceased, may have bought a piece of property some 20 years ago for, let's say, $100,000.
Right.
And today, 20 years later, when he dies, it's worth $200,000.
Right.
Therefore, at the taxpayer's death, the property is reevaluated at $200,000, and therefore that is the heir's basis in the property. So
right.
They could turn around and sell it today and pay no capital gains at $200,000.
If they sold it at $200,000, they inherited it at $200,000, so they had no capital gains because their basis or their cost in the deal was actually $200,000.
That's right.
Instead of
tax deferred, now tax free.
Right, right. Good. Yeah, thanks for clearing that. You know, there's a lot of lingo in the 1031 exchange arena that's kind of 1031 specific, and you've mentioned a couple of things. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Well, I'd love to. Yes. Pretty much to set it up, I'd like to go through and discuss some vocabulary words that we can build on when we get a little bit deeper and a little bit more complex as we
Great.
Go forward. What I'd like to discuss is the relinquished property. What does that term mean? That, very simply, is in the exchange field anyway, it's what you sell to begin the exchange. That's the relinquished property, what you sell, and the money goes into escrow. That's the relinquished property.
Right.
The replacement property is actually what you purchase through the exchange. That simply is the property that you purchase in the exchange.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about a simultaneous exchange for 1 minute.
Okay.
A simultaneous exchange is actually where you would sell a relinquished property and purchase one at the same replacement or the same table in a replacement closing. In essence, there inevitably could be the sale of 231 Mulberry Lane, and you could purchase another property in another city at the same table, and that would be a simultaneous exchange. The idea that if you found a buddy of yours and you guys wanted to swap deeds on a piece of property, that
right.
would be considered a simultaneous exchange.
Uh-huh.
And as we go forward a little bit, I want I'll make it clear about some of the pitfalls and some of the ideas through this simultaneous exchange that you'd want to look for. For instance, let's say that you and I, Larry, I owned a piece of property and you owned a piece of property, and we wanted to swap properties together.
Uh-huh.
On one side of this table, I'm a seller. And on one side of the on the other side, I'm a buyer, and vice versa. You're a buyer, you're a seller, and you're a buyer. So in theory, we'd want to get two settlement statements which track the financial impact, showing one me as a buyer, me as a seller, and one me as the buyer. so we could track the financial impact that happened on the each side of the exchange.
Uh-huh.
Does that make any sense?
It does.
Let's go to the identification period. The identification period in doing an exchange or a tax-deferred exchange, you have 45 days to identify a piece of property, and you have another 135 days to actually take title to it.
Uh-huh.
So that's a total of 180 days. That makes sense.
To close on the deal, right. You have so many days.
Close on the deal. It's,
right.
Yeah, it's not 45 days plus 135.
The 45 days is included in the 180.
That is correct.
Right.
Let's see.
Now, how many properties can, up to how many can you identify?
That's a very good question. In the identification, there are actually three rulings. So the first ruling would be the three-property rule. The three-property rule would state that you could identify three properties regardless of their value. For instance, let's create a little application for a second.
Okay.
Let's say that we sold a $100,000 replacement a relinquished property.
Right.
We could identify one $100,000 piece, one $200,000 piece, and one $5 million piece.
Right.
If the taxpayer wished to purchase all three of those and add new money to the deal, it would be fine. Under the three-property rule, he could say, Bill, I want you to allocate, $33,000 to exchange number one or replacement property number one. I want you to do $33,000 to replacement property number three, et cetera, and so on. And they could receive new debt, which would be fine as long as they spend all of the equity which goes into escrow,
uh-huh,
and they pick back up all of the debt which they relieve at the relinquished property closing. They're going to be fine. They will be considered to have deferred all their taxes.
Right.
Before we get into that, Larry, because that kind of could get somewhat complex, I want to go back to the vocabulary words. In essence, I would like to define like-kind property because some of these people may be saying, well, geez, he's starting, to discuss deals and deal points, and we don't even know what qualifies yet, from a 1031 aspect.
Absolutely.
Like-kind property is really anything that is held for investment, productive use and trade, or for business. In essence, you may say, well, Bill, I've got a rental home, and I want to do an exchange for that, and I would like to buy a shopping center with the proceeds of the sale of my relinquished rental home.
Right.
I'd say, fine. That's like-kind property.
Because it's real property.
That's right. It's real property held for investment. So in theorem, the only type of real property that's not held for investment is really a personal residence.
Uh-huh.
And so you could trade a condo for raw land. You could trade raw land for apartments, commercial properties, duplexes, rental homes, shopping centers, office buildings. Anything that's held for investment is like kind to 1031.
Uh-huh.
And you may say, well, Bill, that's kind of doesn't make any sense. It's, it's like kind is so broad.
Right.
And I guess when you get into condemnation, I believe that's Code Section 1033,
uh-huh,
the laws are a little bit different. It's a similar kind, meaning it's raw dirt for raw dirt or, a
There are currently
right.
40 participants in your conference.
Kind property, the definition of like kind property under Code Section 1031 is very broad.
Uh-huh.
The idea that this like-kind property, especially in North Carolina, can be purchased through an identification which is in can be identified in three ways. The first one was the three-property rule, which would allow you to identify three properties regardless of their value.
Sure.
And purchase any mix or match of property as long as you spend all the cash that you receive from the proceeds that went into escrow, as well as any debt you relieve at the relinquished property closing.
Right. You have to take on at least as much debt that you had on the existing or on the relinquished property.
That's right. It's kind of funny. It's in the netting boot rules. Netting boot forward is okay. Netting boot backward is not.
Explain that a little bit. That's one of those 1031 specific terms.
All right, let's create a little application again. I love these applications. You sell for $100,000.
Uh huh.
You have $50,000 in equity, and $50,000 was bank debt.
Right.
Which was released to the bank at the closing. I escrowed $50,000 in cash.
Uh huh.
Because we have to spend, as a rule of thumb now, equal to or greater than any cash we receive, and equal to or greater than any mortgage we relieve.
Right.
We would theoretically have to pick up $50,000 if we found a $100,000 replacement property. The taxpayer would instruct me to bring $50,000 to the closing table, and we'd go get $50,000 of third-party bank debt,
uh-huh.
And that meets the criteria. What if the taxpayer says, well, geez, I want to borrow more money. Let's say I want to borrow $60,000 and only bring $40,000 to the table, leaving $10,000 in the exchange escrow.
Right.
Which I'm going to have to give back to that taxpayer at the end of the day. It's not my money.
Right.
So, therefore, the IRS is going to consider that he netted boot backward, and that was not good.
So, if I understand correctly, is he going to pay taxes on $10,000?
That would be correct. Netting boot forward is where the taxpayer would say, well, geez, Bill, you bring your $50,000 to the table, and it's my $50,000. It's in your exchange escrow, but I'm instructing you to bring it to the table.
Right.
And I'm going to bring I'm going to bring $50,000 of my cash dollars out of my jean pocket, and we're not going to get any bank debt. That's okay, as long as I spent all of what I would term the funny money.
Uh-huh.
The 1031 tax-deferred exchange money, the funny money.
But it's okay not to take on $50,000 in debt.
That's right. Bring it right
from the relinquished property.
They bring it right out of their jean pocket if they want to.
Uh-huh.
Or they can call their best friend and borrow it from him.
Oh, okay.
In other words, we're bringing the money. We're bringing all the money we had in the escrow, but we could supplement it with money either from our checking account or some other third party. And that's kind of netting boot forward. Does that make any sense?
It does. It does. But we couldn't buy a cheaper property.
No, sir.
You couldn't buy a cheaper property, but even though you had $50,000 in debt, you could forego taking on a $50,000 mortgage if you had an extra $50,000 in your own personal checking account.
You got it.
Okay, I understand.
Do you want me to go into net exchange proceed amounts? And I guess where I'm going with this is the rule of thumb is you must spend equal to or greater than any money that you receive into escrow, as well as any equal to or greater than any debt that you will leave at the relinquished property closing.
Whether the replacement property has debt on it or not. You at least have to spend that
correct.
Much.
That's correct. In other words, you could bring the debt that you relieved from your jean pocket.
Right.
And it would be fine.
Right. That's great. That is a good explanation. What about the different types of exchanges? Are there different types?
Absolutely. I want to completely cover this one little subject just to make sure that everybody understands that this equal to or greater or equal to and equal or greater and equal or greater in
okay.
Money versus debt. there is an availability or an allocability of expenses inside an exchange. For instance, if you have $100,000 sale, and let's say you paid your realtor $10,000, and you paid the qualified intermediary fees, and you paid some attorney fees. Those are allocable in the exchange, and let's say that they were $12,000
uh-huh.
in total.
Right.
Your responsibility or your net exchange proceed amount would only be $88,000 at that time.
Right.
That's all you would have to replace.
That's what your replacement property has to come up to.
That's correct.
In other words, I'm with you.
I can only give you those three allocable expenses, which were, again, brokerage commissions, attorney's fees, and qualified intermediary fees.
Oh, I'm with you.
Yeah, and for the most part, I want everybody to stick to the rule of thumb.
Uh-huh.
Would you like me to move to the 200% rule?
That sounds great. Yeah.
Okay. This is the second ruling for identifying properties, which is the 200% rule. In essence, let's say that you sold a $100,000 piece. You can identify as many properties as you want as long as their aggregate, meaning their added up fair market value, does not exceed 200% of the relinquished property of fair market value.
Right.
Is in this case $100,000.
Right.
So we could identify four $50,000 pieces and qualify under the 200% rule because we had only $100,000 worth of relinquished property proceeds.
Can you identify four? Aren't you limited to three?
No, sir. This
okay.
is the 200% rule and the second rule.
Oh, the second of the – okay, I'm with you. I'm with you.
Yes, sir. It's really hard to do this over the phone.
No, that's okay. I do understand.
I apologize.
I do understand. You have the one rule where you can identify up to three, but I also think it's important, Bill, to share with everybody why it's important, even though you may only be going to buy one property, why you should identify three or possibly even four properties within that 45 days.
That's right, because on the morning of the 46th day, it's actually midnight of the 45th day, if you have identified something and for whatever reason, if there's an environmental issue or the seller goes south on you and you can't purchase the property, you're stuck. You're
title problems, whatever.
Absolutely, a myriad of things.
Yeah.
And there is one little catch, 22, in the fact that if, in fact, you do identify, let's say that we sold for $100,000 and we do identify three $100,000 pieces of property.
Right.
If there is no material reason why those properties, which is beyond the taxpayer's control, the money's stuck with a qualified intermediary till the 181st day.
Uh-huh.
Because, mind you, there's nothing that can frustrate an exchange until the morning of the 46th day, and if you have identified properties out there that are open and that could possibly be purchased, other than due to something that's out of the control of the taxpayer, the money's stuck in the escrow till 181st day.
Right.
If, for instance, you decide that in other words, we would never suggest for one instance that someone buy a piece of real estate to save taxes.
Uh-huh.
That would probably be a bad idea.
Right. You don't buy based on taxes alone.
No, sir. In other words, if this is something that you would buy anyway, and this is a penny because you're working with before tax dollars, in other words, federally 15%, and North Carolina, I believe it's 7%, so that's, what, 22% more cash to work with.
Yeah.
And so if it made sense and you were going to buy that property anyway, then it's probably a good 1031. But we wouldn't want to buy a piece of property that's a dog just to save the tax.
You don't want to pay retail just to save the taxes.
Well, I don't know if pay retail is the right word, but
deal.
I wouldn't want to buy a property that I normally wouldn't buy if I wasn't under these times.
Make a bad deal, yeah.
That's it.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right. Now, share with me, you talk about during the 45 days, you have to identify a property. Say that you're doing a 1031 for me as a qualified intermediary, which you have to do. You can't just get your attorney that does the closing to do it. You have to have one of those. Mm-hmm. And we'll go into that in a little bit. But say you're holding it for me, and what do I forget where I was going with this now. You mentioned about the 45 days.
Yes.
On the 45 days, say I've identified three, what do I do? Call you up and tell you, and then you fax something to the IRS?
No, sir. You can identify to a party to the transaction. We, as the qualified intermediary, would require that you identify to us by via telefax as well, return receipt requested mail.
Certified mail.
Certified mail.
Sent to you within 45 days.
Postmarked before midnight of the 45th day.
To you. So there's not something that goes to the IRS that goes to you, right?
No, it goes to me, and I hold it in case of audit.
Oh, okay. I'm with you.
And I want two proofs.
I don't blame you. You want a fax that shows the date at the top of it.
Absolutely.
And then the certified mail. That's a good point. I can't just call you up and say, hey, I'm going to buy 125 Fall Street and 529 Oakland.
Duck.
Yeah, really. Yeah. I hear you.
Okay.
Hey, share this with me. There's different types of exchanges, but what about, can you do this in reverse?
Absolutely. In other words, it's a reverse exchange. Revenue Procedure 2000-37. That was obviously made available, I believe it was in April of 2000. There are specific regs which suggest that you can buy a replacement property before you sell a relinquished property. This would be on a case-by-case basis, and it's a four-hour discussion in itself.
Wow.
So the watch does exist. I can't teach you how to fix it tonight.
Right. But it's just a brief overview. You can buy a property before you sell the relinquished property.
Kind of. Sort
right.
Of. In essence, what you would do is hire an EAT, an exchange accommodation title holder. Probably owned solely owned entity of your qualified intermediary that's not a qualified intermediary.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. I thought you just used the same entity.
No, sir. In other words, this would be a specially designed corporation which would go out and have one property in it, i.e., and be the exchange accommodation title holder for that replacement property.
Right.
In theorem, the EAT would go out and buy the replacement property on behalf of the taxpayer and would be allowed to hold it for 180 days before or within 180 days of the EAT taking title to the replacement property. The taxpayer would have to sell the relinquished property, and therefore that would start the straightforward exchange, and we would go through and just buy from the EAT.
I'm with you. I follow you. That makes sense. So you'd put up the money to buy the replacement property in advance and then have 6 months or 180 days to sell the relinquished property. Wow. It can get complicated.
Well, you can throw multi-asset into that, as I alluded to in the beginning, where there are many relinquished for many replacements. I can pretty much make 1031 do what you want to do as long as you give me enough heads up and we talk enough that I can design it for you. You might have to shoot through some hoops, but I can make it do what you want to do.
Man, there's so much to this.
It is kind of confusing, and I do apologize. I wish you were sitting in front of me and I could create some diagrams for you
That's okay. It's a lot of information and it's very detailed information. And before we get off the call, if you don't mind, I'd like you to give out your contact information because I know you'll have questions starting tomorrow.
It'd be my pleasure.
Let me ask you this question.
Yes, sir.
When I am selling my property do I have to put something in my contract that says I intend on doing this as a 1031 exchange?
Very good question. It's called a cooperation clause.
Uh-huh.
And typically in the commercial form, I believe it is number 16.
Uh-huh.
Which would simply state that my taxpayer being, if we're going in the straightforward fashion, my taxpayer would be the seller at that juncture, and it would say seller intends to do a tax-free exchange.
Uh-huh.
And buyer agrees to cooperate as long as it doesn't cost him any money, delay closing, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
That could go and should probably go in the purchase agreement.
Uh-huh.
Theoretically, me as the qualified intermediary, I'm going to do, and maybe we can get that in a minute about how mechanically, what is a qualified intermediary and what does he do?
Right.
Mechanically, I'm going to set up an assignment and notification language to that buyer.
Uh-huh.
In essence, I'm going to create a document. I'm going to write a letter to the buyer's closing attorney, telling him what to do with the HUD, what to do with the 1099, what to do with the deeds, where to send the money, tell him what the escrow number is, the ABA routing number.
You're handling
all
it all.
Stuff, all of it, A to Z.
Right.
And theoretically, I'm going to send him assignment notification, so I'm actually going to take assignment of the relinquished purchase agreement where my taxpayer is the seller. I'm actually going to become the seller, and I'm going to get the buyer to agree to cooperate as long as it doesn't cost him any money, delay closing, et cetera.
So basically, then, the seller will sign the contract, but they're going to assign it to you.
To the qualified intermediary. That's right. And
oh.
I'm going to create that.
Uh-huh.
And what I'm going to do is I'm going to put direct deeding in that agreement where
uh-huh.
I get caught in equitable title only.
Uh-huh.
In essence, I'm going to route the money to an exchange escrow
mm-hmm.
that I can't touch, and the taxpayer can't touch unless we mutually agree to touch it together. And
both parties sign off on it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. An escrow agreement, we use Branch Banking and Trust here in Charlotte.
Uh-huh.
Downtown Branch, BB&T, has been my escrow holder for a decade.
Wow. Hey, here's a good question. Can I earn interest on my money while it's in there?
You sure can.
Can I?
Yes, sir. You
Great.
Sure can. You have to pay tax on it as ordinary income.
Right.
And we do pay interest depending on how much money that you have with us.
Uh-huh.
And that's our fees are... our flat fees, and we do receive a piece of the interest
mm-hmm.
To be able to give this level of service.
To do that, absolutely.
That's correct.
Yeah. That's great. Let me ask you this question. I'm sure there are a lot of people probably on the call that are thinking, you know, you got to be doing $500,000 deal for it to be worth it. And I know you probably have an average size deal, but just what is an average size deal?
Our average size deal is about $500,000.
Uh-huh.
My smallest deal has been $11,000, and my largest deal has been $389
million. $389 million?
Yes, sir.
Man, did BB&T take you out to lunch that month?
The money actually did not hit escrow. We moved it from Florida to Texas and California all in one fell swoop.
Wow. That's pretty strong.
Never even touched escrow.
Man, that was a fat deal. That's pretty neat. That's impressive. That's impressive. Tell me this. Is there a threshold for a number or a size of a deal where, based on the expenses, it becomes worthwhile to consider a 1031 exchange?
That is a really good question, and I invite everyone to use their calculators. Basically, the tax from a federal standpoint is 15% of any gain federally,
mm-hmm.
and for North Carolina, it's 7% for state. So
right.
If you plug on a 22% figure,
uh-huh.
I have a flat fee. My fees are $950 for a list of services, which I invite anyone to come through and ask for.
Right.
We'll issue it to them. It's a flat fee. I don't care how many zeros are attached.
Uh-huh.
What does pique our interest is if it's a lot of money, we give a lot of interest. If it's not a lot of money, we keep a majority of the interest.
Sure.
if that makes any sense.
Well, that makes sense because you're only holding it for, you know, who knows how long, up to 180 days. But I'm sure it probably,
there's
a lot of them close
about
before
90
that.
Days.
About 90?
An average about 90. That's
oh,
right.
Okay.
And again, Larry, you can move as fast as you want. You can tell me to ship the money to any state in the United States except for Nevada, please. You know, that at that relinquished property closing table, I can wire transfer it anywhere you want to go. You can move as fast as you want to go.
Yeah, because...
You know, it can be with me for 10 days. It can be with me for two.
Because you can handle about a transaction in about every state except Nevada, right?
That is correct.
That's pretty strong. So it's not like being a realtor or an attorney, you know, licensed in certain states. You can, like you mentioned, you went from Florida to Texas to wherever. But
exactly.
You can handle Texas transactions anywhere.
Well, we boycotted Nevada. They make me bond out in that state, so I'm not going there.
I hear you. They're just worried about all the casinos buying and selling. That's why they're
thinking I'm going to sell one of their casinos or something.
Yeah, really. Let me ask you this question.
At what point
does a qualified intermediary begin to get involved in the transaction?
That's a great question. Obviously, before the relinquished property closing. In other words, I would like to have a week. Sometimes I have people call me at the closing table, and obviously things are a flutter. But if you've done business with us, we can get it done pretty much ASAP. Obviously, the signatures for the documentation have to come afterwards, and the money's already been moved.
But, uh-huh.
You know, that's no sweat for our repeat clients, and some that understand who we are, that's fine.
Right. That's good. It's good to know that if you need to, you can dive on a deal and make it happen right quick.
Absolutely. In other words, as long as they have not signed the deed and the money has not transferred into their hands, remember, I must create an assignment notification to the buyer, and I must instruct that attorney to make the check in favor of the exchange escrow, not the taxpayer.
Uh-huh.
And as long as that we're in and time to do that, there's no big deal. Typically, we charge a $500 rush fee if somebody calls me, you know, a day or so ahead. I'd like to have 3 to 5 business days worth of notice.
Right. That makes sense. That makes sense. You want a little bit of time to be able to prepare, right?
Well, you know, I don't want to push things or cram a square peg in a round hole, obviously.
Right.
You know, I want to make sure everything qualifies and, you know, everything's good and, you know, the property's where it should be and what's going on.
Uh-huh. That's great. Man, there's a lot to this. There is a lot to this. And basically the attorney cannot be an intermediary, can they?
Anyone can be a qualified intermediary.
Uh-huh.
But the
attorney handling the transaction, it's a different entity altogether.
Well, in theorem, if there's anyone that's done any work for you over the past 2 years and has received compensation for that, they become a disqualified person.
Uh-huh.
Anybody that's related to you is a disqualified person.
Oh, wow.
I certainly would be very careful in who I chose as my qualified intermediary because they may not have the tools or the knowledge to actually complete the exchange in a good manner for you.
Uh-huh.
So you need to do your research when you're choosing a qualified intermediary.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That makes good sense. That's good to know. I didn't know those. I didn't know that particular thing.
Absolutely.
Wow, that's interesting. There is a lot to this, but there's a lot of money to be saved. Now, let me ask you this question.
If I do
a 1031... and I relinquish a property, and then I have a replacement property, can I do it again in a year or two later?
A year later, yes, sir. Call me right back up, and we'll be in the saddle again. No problem.
Wow.
I want to make that 365-day with one tax year or one tax filing.
Uh-huh.
I want to make that bar. And if we can make that bar, I'm satisfied, and you should be safe.
Yeah. That's great. Now, the money is held in an escrow account. It's like an insured account. I mean, the money's safe and everything, right?
Let's hope, or I'd be in Leavenworth.
I hear you.
Yeah, it's with BB&T, and it's in an FDIC insured account. It's nothing more than a checking account with BB&T.
But it's, I guess it's with an escrow account, right?
Yes, sir. And there are special stipulations which make it the qualified escrow account.
Uh-huh.
In essence, the taxpayer has no constructive receipt, but I can't run off with their money because I got to have their signature before I can move it.
Right.
And that is part and parcel to some of the documentation that Realty Exchange would provide to these clients. They'll actually sign an escrow agreement which will have BB&T and I on it.
Uh-huh.
And it will set out exactly what we're to do with the money and exactly what we can and we can't do.
Okay. Okay. That's good. Now, can I exchange a property with a relative? Like,
ooh,
if you know, if my uncle owns a property and we want to swap properties or something, or does it have to be an arm's length transaction?
It is a related party transaction. And for our purposes this evening, it is possible.
Uh-huh.
I like it when, if you did an exchange with a third party who purchased your relinquished property,
mm-hmm.
and you came and you possibly bought a replacement property from a relative, as long as that relative did an exchange as well, I think it would qualify. They're looking, it's in 1031F, and it's kind of the right pocket, left pocket kind of scenario. Let's see if I can do this correctly, Larry. Let's say that you bought a property in 1980, and
mm-hmm.
you and I are brothers, okay? You
mm-hmm.
bought a piece of property that you bought it for, say, 20 grand. It's now worth 100. I just bought a property. I'm your brother. I just bought a property for $100,000. And I have no basis or no basis issues in my property.
Right.
Because it's worth $100,000. Let's assume somebody wanted to buy your property.
Mm-hmm.
And you and I swapped properties, and you got my property that the guy didn't want, but I got yours, and I had your basis in the property, and he sold it.
Uh-huh.
Sold it.
Uh-huh.
The IRS basically considers family members, and that would be your mother, your father, your brother, your mother, your father, your brother, your sister, your son, your daughter, or your grandchild
uh-huh.
as a related party, or a corporation which you own 50% or more would be a related party. And this 1031F, right pocket, left pocket thing would go on.
Uh-huh.
Because I would have turned around and sold my high basis property after I swapped it with you, and we'd have been family members, and that whoever would have bought that would have been whoever would have bought that would have gone, and there would have been no taxes
right.
with our economic family unit.
Uh huh.
And that's kind of the issue that I would like to reserve. Yes, it'll work, but I want to look at that very closely in related party transactions.
Uh-huh. Well, that's good to know that you can, but you just have to be careful and make sure you make all the documentation correct and you know, dot your I's and cross your T's. Speaking of that, are there a lot of documents involved in doing one of these?
That's great. I can give you a quick overview of the documentation. How are we doing on time?
Yeah, we're doing good. We have another 15 minutes probably if we need it, 20 minutes.
Okay. Let's see here. Okay. All right. There should be an exchange agreement.
Uh-huh.
To begin the exchange.
Uh-huh.
There should be an assignment notification to the buyer, and that would be on the we would sign the purchase agreement and notify the buyer
that
we intend to do an exchange through that document. That's right.
Right.
Get him to agree to cooperate.
Uh huh.
And on the replacement side, we would have an assignment and notification to seller as well. There's something else I didn't bring up. Incidentally, when the money's in escrow and you identify these properties, they can use the exchange escrow to put down binder monies,
uh-huh.
i.e. it takes valuable consideration to bind a contract in North Carolina. They can use their exchange escrow, and that is a no additional fee.
Uh-huh.
We're used to doing that. We can put binders out on intended replacement properties. If they don't want to buy it, we can suck the binder back in, and that is not constructive receipt.
Uh-huh. Okay, I'm with you.
Okay. Let's see. So we've got the assignment and notification to seller. We've got the identification documentation. There should be some type of a First Amendment in a deferred exchange. In essence, when we entered into the exchange agreement, we basically knew what the relinquished property was, but we had no idea what the replacement property was.
Uh-huh.
So we should probably amend the agreement to show what the replacement property is and to identify it into this agreement.
Right.
And to include it.
Right.
So there should be some type of an amendment.
Uh-huh.
Let's assume that they didn't identify to me. There might should be a termination agreement, which would relieve the rights of the qualified intermediary and get the money out of escrow and make sure everybody says, okay, we're clear and it's clean and here's the exchange. We've terminated.
Mm-hmm.
Realty exchange typically will do a final exchange, or should I say interim and final exchange statement
uh-huh.
for the taxpayer. We'll do... A statement which will track the financial impact on the relinquished side of the transaction as well as the financial impact on the replacement side of the transaction.
Uh-huh.
It's a handy little tool for the taxpayer's CPA. We'll also do a draft. I comment draft. We are not CPAs.
Right.
But we're not going to let them make mistakes either.
Sure.
We're going to do a draft form of the 8824, which is the form that you will show to the IRS the following April, should you be on a calendar year,
uh-huh.
To show them that you've done this exchange.
Uh-huh.
That's pretty much the documentation in its nutshell. Now, Realty Exchange does take, you know, the time to call, to write letters of reminders, to discuss issues like, for instance, you may say in a type of an exchange, well, could I build a building on the replacement property side? Sure you can. Just let me know what you want to do, and as long as we complete or virtually complete the improvements during this time, I can set the exchange up to do a build-to-suit transaction.
Oh, wow. Does that happen very often?
Yeah, we do a lot of it.
Do you really? That is amazing. That is amazing.
Well, think about this. You sell for $100,000.
Uh-huh.
We go and we find a $20,000 piece of raw dirt.
Uh-huh.
We have BTS Charlotte. There are 7 corporations, actually, that are set up to do this.
Right.
Where I affectionately call them Born to Screw Charlotte. No, I'm kidding. Build-to-suit Charlotte. Build-to-suit Charlotte. They go out and they take title to the replacement property
uh-huh.
during the exchange period.
Right.
And Realty Exchange can loan them money, and they can borrow money. The taxpayer can borrow money, or i.e. they can hire BTS Charlotte to actually be the primary obligor of a loan.
Oh, okay.
And let's say that we bought a piece of raw dirt for $20,000, and we need to put $80,000 of additional improvements to suck up the monies from our relinquished property.
Sure.
Well, you may say, well, Bill, what if we can't get it complete? And how are you going to get around that? Well, we'll do a special ID. We can identify the property, i.e., the raw dirt.
Right.
And it's a pertinent improvements as drawn by Joe Blow on said date. And that would allow us to slide up and down the scale of completion as long as we had the intent to finish it from
uh-huh.
the get-go.
Right.
I wouldn't want to just try to put the slab in and put some bricks and sticks up and say we're done. I would want us to run out of time. I wouldn't want to build until we ran out of time.
Uh-huh.
But build a suit exchange, sure, no problem.
So now, does the person doing the 1031 actually own the property when they buy, or did you say Realty Exchange can?
Yeah, so a solely owned entity of Realty Exchange.
You'll buy it and get the loan on it and that sort of thing?
We could have the taxpayer do it, or we could have BTS Charlotte do it. We, in actuality, could have the seller allow us to start to improve the property before my taxpayer takes title.
Uh-huh.
You can't build on something that you already own with exchange money and have it qualify.
Right.
So I couldn't buy the $20,000 chunk of dirt and then use my $80,000 to build on it.
Right.
I'd have to either let the seller do it, hire a contractor to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, those two entities are lienable. So if they get out and they do something cuckoo and they get leaned up and you get caught up into a mess,
it could mess up your deal.
Absolutely. So that's why the existence of this actual build-to-suit entity exists.
Uh-huh. Okay.
It's a single asset entity at that time.
Uh-huh.
It's established for the taxpayer, period.
Okay, so it's a separate entity that's set up mm-hmm. for that individual, for that transaction.
Yeah, for that build-it-suit exchange, that's correct.
Oh, okay. And mm-hmm. and that's an entity here in Charlotte?
Yeah, it's primarily owned by a Realty Exchange.
Oh, okay.
There's seven of them.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And wow.
It's a vehicle to get this type of exchange accomplished.
That's good to know, because we're working on one personally that we have on the market for sale. We're wanting to roll it over. It's a commercial mm-hmm. piece that we bought, that we mm-hmm. have it listed for $300, and we're hoping to put a fast food or something on it, and then roll that into something else. Once hopefully a fast food or somebody takes it over, then we can roll that into something else.
That would be great.
A build-to-suit would be neat. Yeah.
Well, I don't believe. Have you already purchased the dirt?
Yeah, we already own it, and it's on the market now.
Uh-huh. And you're intending to sell it as raw dirt, or you're intending to improve it before you sell it?
We're intending to sell it as raw dirt.
And you've owned it for how long?
Well, we've owned it for. It's kind of odd that we have two pieces that we had to put together. So one mm-hmm. of them we haven't owned that long. The other one we've owned maybe 6 months. But it's probably going to be 6 months realistically before it closes.
Okay. Under 1031, I would invite you to give me a call.
Uh-huh.
Is what I would do.
Okay.
At your convenience.
Because we may need to hold it a little longer than we're thinking.
Yeah, I'm thinking so, and I would like to discuss through since it's not ABC. LLC, it's you. I think maybe you and I ought to talk about that.
Yeah, okay.
You probably ought to hold it just a little bit longer.
Yeah, maybe so.
I can discuss that.
Well, we've got it on the market now anyway, so, we can always set up a date or whatever to make
sure
it closes, gives us the length of time or whatever, although I hate to ever delay a closing.
I understand.
Yeah, so,
1031 is not for everybody.
Yeah.
Certainly, if you do not intend to stay in real estate, you do not want to be doing the 1031.
Well, it's kind of funny. You hear people say what the three most important things in real estate are, but you know what the two most important are, don't you?
Well, I know they start with location, right?
Well, no. The three most important things are make offers, make offers, make offers.
Uh-huh.
But the two most important things are close the deal and get the check.
That sounds like a plan.
That's the two most important things in real estate.
Except in 1031, it goes completely opposite of that.
Exactly.
Make sure the deal closes and I get the check.
Yeah, make sure you get the check.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's your three most important things in real estate.
Exactly. You can't touch it.
Hey, let me ask you this question, Bill. Can I
uh-huh.
can I do one of these transactions if I have a vacation home that I'm selling?
Wow, great question. Criteria for qualifying a vacation home. Again, I'm not a CPA, but here's enough to get you started.
Uh-huh.
Probably ought to not live in it more than 2 weeks out of the year.
Uh-huh.
You probably ought to receive some type of a fair market rent from it.
Uh-huh.
You probably ought to depreciate it from your tax return.
Mm-hmm.
And considering that you've held it for a qualified use period and those three things do exist, which establishes that you've held it for rent, you
right.
may say, well, Bill, I can only – it's a sunshine lease. It's a place down at the beach. It rents in the summer and during golf season, but it doesn't rent any other time. And I'm saying, fine, Larry, as long as you've got a fair market rent from it, and you're actually trying to do it, it's form over substance. It is for rent, and it's not a second home.
Right.
It does qualify.
Uh-huh.
If, for instance, you may say, well, Bill, I live in the thing for, 6 months, there's a possibility on a case-by-case basis that we may be able to bifurcate even time. In essence, you might say, well, I use half of it for business.
Uh-huh.
And I rent half of it out.
Uh-huh.
Well, maybe we bifurcate investment versus personal use.
Uh-huh.
In other words, there are a lot of possibilities as long as we can get a full understanding of what's going on and how the transaction lays out. We can make some recommendations or at least put enough teeth into it for these taxpayers to go to their tax counsel.
Sure.
And obviously we're ready to talk to their tax counsel at no charge.
Mm-hmm.
From us, to get him at least thinking on the same page, and then he can do whatever research and whatever recommendations he wants to his own taxpayer.
Exactly. That's good. That's good to know. How about this?
Mm-hmm.
We do some deals occasionally where a owner has carried back a mortgage, or maybe we're going to carry back a mortgage, mm-hmm. or we have a property that we've seller financed or whatever.
Okay.
Are there any rules for if you have a seller finance deal or purchase money mortgage, as a lot of them call it?
Sure, PMNs.
Mm-hmm.
Man, that's a good one. Where'd you get that one?
Yeah, you gave it to me.
Wow, okay. the idea, Larry, that purchase money mortgage is also a term we did not get to tonight, is
uh-huh.
boot, or could be a type of boot.
Right.
I.e. boot being cash, believe
mm-hmm.
it's a debt, or in this case, a purchase money mortgage.
Right.
Let's talk about you as a seller of a $100,000 piece of property, which you own for cash.
Right.
Me as the buyer, I come to you, and I say, look, I've got $50,000 cash, but you need to take back a purchase money note in the amount of $50,000.
Uh-huh.
And you'd say, well, fine, but I'm doing an exchange. And the qualified intermediary would show up on deck and say, hey, no problem, Larry. What we're going to do is we're going to accept the cash into escrow, and we're going to make the note payable to Realty Exchange, Inc., as qualified intermediary for Larry.
Uh-huh.
And at that time, that purchase money note goes into escrow.
Right.
Any payments that are made on that note during the time frame which it is the property of the qualified intermediary
during the 180 days
are simply put into the escrow. They go straight into the escrow and are the property of that exchange.
Oh, okay.
For instance, the way to get out of the note gets a little bit tricky, or the way we would recommend you do it is, for instance, you find a replacement property worth $100,000 to keep the math simple.
Right.
We would bring the $50,000 to the table. And at that time, we would assign the purchase money note to the seller, i.e. that seller's going to start screaming because you agreed to pay him $100,000 cash,
uh-huh.
not $50,000 cash in a purchase money note.
Right.
So what you do, or what the qualified intermediary do, is say, hey, settle down, seller. What we're going to do is immediately post-closing, we're going to buy it back. Remember, we
right.
can't bring too much money to the table, so I don't want to get another mortgage on top of that purchase money note.
Right.
Because it would look like I cashed out. The perfect case in point is Wittig, WITTIG, versus Commissioner, October of 1995.
Uh-huh.
And that was one of those deals where Mr. Wittig tried to overfinance his replacement property.
Uh-huh.
The IRS got upset, and they won in October, and the exchange was disqualified.
Uh-huh.
Subsequently, in January of 96, Wittig overthrew it. And so it's hard to find the site, but we can provide it for people if they'd like.
Oh, wow.
But that's did that answer your question about the purchase money?
It did.
That, again, is a watch that does exist. It takes a while to show you how to fix it.
Yeah. Man, there's so much about this. So much about this. Now, are there, and I just thought of this as we were talking, but are there any advantages for if I have the relinquished property, are there any advantages for me either paying off my loan before the transaction or refinancing it and doing a cash out refi before the transaction?
We had discussed that a little bit in the beginning, and that, again, is a big point. We do not ever want to fool around with any ownership attributes, debt equity ratios, or any physicality, meaning an improvement to a building, in anticipation of an exchange. So the answer to your question is refining in anticipation of an exchange and pulling money out is probably a no-no. You say, well, Bill, what if I refied, I didn't pull any money out, and I just was going for a better interest rate? That may be okay. But I wouldn't want to see a taxpayer pull money out, and I really wouldn't want to see him pull money out right after the closing of the replacement property either,
Either
because of WIDIC.
Right. That makes good sense. It really does. Man, this has been a tremendous amount of information tonight, Bill.
Well, I just appreciate the opportunity, and if I can ever help you, Larry, please do not hesitate to contact me.
Would you mind giving out your contact information if anybody on the call or that may be able to hear this recording in the future, that if they have a question, they could give you a call?
Yes. My contact information is as follows. Bill Choate, Choate, at 821 Baxter, Baxter Street, Suite 318, Charlotte, NC, 28202. My phone number is 704-342-1031.
Wow.
My fax
is
744-1031. Our website is www.rexonline.com. That ought to do it right there.
That's great. That's a lot of information.
Oh, and this obviously is Realty Exchange, Inc.
rexonline.com.
Yep, for Realty Exchange, Inc.
And you know what? I've been on your website the whole time we've been on this call, and there is a tremendous amount of information on this website, all about exchanges. You have the different services. I didn't realize you had a development company and then the build-to-suit company. You have a knowledge base on here with private rulings and reference materials and related party transactions. I mean, it's amazing. And you have FAQ and a resource guide, even a vocabulary that's huge on here. I just couldn't believe it.
Well, I'm just glad you went out and checked it out.
Oh, yeah. I've been on it the whole time we've been on the call. Where do you think I'm getting my questions?
Where you got that one. That was a good one.
Oh, but this is great. I really appreciate having you on the call tonight.
Well, thank you for this opportunity, and should you ever be in need of my service, I'll be more than happy to help you. And if you want to call me on that deal that you have, I'll be more than happy to help you with that.
That would be great. I'd love to. Hopefully, I'll be able to soon. Hopefully, we'd get somebody that would get it under contract. That would
Larry,
be nice.
Larry, I've had a lot of fun, and I thank you.
Well, I thank you, and I really appreciate it. I appreciate everybody listening in tonight, and I appreciate you giving us the opportunity to pick your brain for an hour and 15 minutes or so. And,
well, come back for more if you like.
That sounds great. I really do appreciate it. And thanks, everybody, for calling in tonight. And if anybody has any questions or if you're on the call because you have gotten an email maybe through one of the Yahoo groups or someone forwarded it to you, if you'd like to receive our weekly email, we also have a weekly newsletter that we send out at you can go to www.larrygoins.com. and sign up for that. And if you have any questions, you can feel free to just email us from there. All our contact information is there. So, Bill, thanks a lot for calling in and
for
all the good information. And look forward to working with you in the future.
My pleasure.
Thanks a lot. Everybody have a good night. Good night, Bill.
Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.
Hi, this is Larry Goins, and I would like to thank you for listening to this audio program. I would also like to remind you to please visit our website at www.larrygoins.com for other information, as well as we have a link for freebies. We have articles that you can read. I would like to share with you that we also offer one-day training events for basic real estate investing, and we also have three-day boot camps, as well as the boot camp in a box, which contains the complete three-day boot camp on audio CD as well as DVD video. Please visit our website for the location and schedule of our one-day and three-day boot camps coming up. We also have a home study course called The Complete Insider's Guide to Financing for Investors, which consists of over 500 pages in the manual and 10 audio CDs, as well as 2 forms discs and other products and services as well. We also offer personal coaching and mentoring, so whatever your needs may be, please feel free to give us a call. If you are a real estate group, investor association, mortgage company owner, or other organization and would like to have either myself or Wendy Sweet or Leon Humphrey speak at your group about real estate and finance and investing, please feel free to give us a call. Our direct office number is 803-831-0056. I am at extension 304. Wendy Sweet is 310. I'd also like to remind you that we also offer traditional financing as well as hard money and rehab loans for investors. Please visit our website there at www.financialhelpservices.com. Thank you very much for your business. We sincerely appreciate it. And please remember, our mission is to put people and principles in front of profits. When we do that, everybody profits. Thank you and have a great day.